Support for the Legislative Gazette comes from New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals standing with more than 600,000 workers in education, human services, and healthcare with the Our Voice, Our Values, Our Union campaign. And United University Professions, representing 37,000 academic and professional employees at SUNY campuses and teaching hospitals across New York State. Frederick E. Cole, President. UUPinfo.org.
The often lengthy state budget hearings began this week at the state capitol as legislators heard testimony on Governor Cuomo's spending plan and how to close a $6 billion gap. The process, however, was assailed by both the left and the right. More now from the Legislative Gazette's Karen DeWitt.
My name is Basil Sagos. I'm the commissioner of the DEC.
The hearings began with the environmental conservation portion of the state budget. But 4 minutes into State Environmental Commissioner Basil Sagos' opening statement, the hearing room erupted into chants as protesters advocating for anti-climate change legislation surrounded Sagos and the lawmakers. After a couple of minutes, Senate Finance Committee Chair Liz Krueger, a Democrat, told protesters they would have to be quiet.
You can go back to your seats and listen.
The demonstrators were finally gently escorted out by state police.
All right, done. Go. Bye. Go yell at the governor.
Commissioner Sagos told lawmakers that while he may disagree with some of the protesters' tactics, they aren't wrong.
It's been the 10 hottest years on record. There are fires burning in Australia. There's droughts all across the world. There's floods impacting communities. They're right. And we all should take that to heart. And I know the governor is.
Meanwhile, at a suburban hotel a few minutes outside of Albany, the state's conservative party held its annual meeting. Several Republican lawmakers who were in the minority in both the Senate and the Assembly called for reform of the budget process. Assembly Minority Leader Will Barclay says the budget should be limited to financial items. He says too many unrelated major policy issues are lumped in with the budget and voted on, often into the late evening hours, when each item should instead be considered on its own.
The process is rigged to advance the governor's agenda, undermine the role of the legislature, and distract from the hard financial choices that we need to be made this year, particularly.
The state faces a $6 billion budget deficit. Barclay says Governor Cuomo has once again included several proposals into this year's budget that don't belong there, such as banning single-use plastic foam containers, legalizing adult recreational use of marijuana, and even amending the state seal and flag to include the words E Pluribus Unum. And Barclay says the policy items included in the budget are sometimes rushed through without proper vetting. He cites the bail reforms approved in 2019 as part of the budget. They're now facing backlash from law enforcement groups and some GOP lawmakers. The changes end most forms of cash bail for nonviolent crimes and have led to some repeat offenders going free until their trial begins. Some Democrats, including Cuomo, have said the law needs tweaking.
Clearly, I don't think a lot of our colleagues from the suburbs and other areas realize the impact that this bail reform was going to have and the public safety crisis we have as a result of that.
Until last year, Republicans were in control of the state Senate for most of the past century and did not object to including unrelated policy items into the spending plan in recent years. But Barclay says just because that happened in the past doesn't make it right going forward. Cuomo's senior advisor, Rich Azzopardi, says the criticism is unfounded. He says the governor and his staff are proud of their budgets and believe the public also likes what's been done.
Anyone who believes that we're circumventing the legislature with a budget voted on by the legislature has clearly flunked middle school social studies.
Azzopardi says the legislature has plenty of time to deliberate over all of the items in the budget and the chance to present its own budget plans before the March 31 deadline. He says a good example is the legislative budget hearings, which often last well into the evenings and will continue through mid-February. In Albany, I'm Karen DeWitt.
You are are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. Joining us now, Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Shartok. Alan, the return of New York Governor Andrew Cuomo. He's been on a bit of a break. You opened the interview with, where have you been?
Where you been? I think he said, where you been? He can be a funny guy. Anyway, it was an interesting interview. He has a number of things that he has to be defensive about, in my mind, one of which is the question of bail. He has been saying that bail reform has to be tweaked. He's absolutely right about one thing. It's been a national disgrace that poor people get held in jail because they don't have the resources. Well, rich people are always out. We know that. But we have to give judges the power to protect people. It's not perfect. It'll never be perfect. I love the idea of bail reform. I think it's important that people who have really done nothing violent or who are not a threat, I think they should be out. But I honestly believe there has to be a place where judges are able to say, no, you should come up with the money in order to make sure that you return.
Well, so the conversation went on for a half an hour. The governor and you had a conversation not only about bail reforms, but about this issue of legalizing marijuana. We know the state's in debt to $6 billion, and this is one way to generate some revenue. And you had a fun go around about that. And what started out, of course, as you've always pointed out, the governor not being for it and now being for it, but only as long as it's, quote, in the budget.
Well, that's right. He's putting it into the budget. That made a lot of news yesterday. The program made a lot of news. WAMC was cited all over the place. And it was an interesting conversation. I have to say I had fun. He is always fun to joust with. He's as smart as anybody. And I'll tell you right now, it was a good contest. So when it came to marijuana, I don't, frankly, know that he really wants marijuana. In the beginning, he was quite clear. He thought it was a gateway drug. He changed his mind. He's for marijuana. But somehow it isn't getting done. And I kid around with him, and I thank him, and I say, well, you know, we're not having problems here in Massachusetts as a result of that, and I want to thank you for all the New York license plates that are parked outside the marijuana place here in Great Barrington, where I live. On the other hand, the selectmen, in their lack of wisdom in this town, have just okayed seven marijuana places. I'm against that. I don't want Great Barrington, my wonderful town, to become the marijuana capital of the world. I think that would be a mistake. We have a very good select woman, Lee Davis, who agrees with that. And, you know, it's just a question of what you want to do. Do you really want to put, these shops where the children are playing in the middle of town? Yeah, they sell liquor in the liquor stores, but it's different. This is a whole new thing. I think the governor has some worries about this. On the other hand, I want him to come clean and say either he's for it or not. And if he's for it, we all know he has the power to make it happen.
You also talked about the phrase e pluribus unum.
Yes, the whole idea of, you know, everybody becoming one. You know, David, this is a governor who right now understands how terrible the anti-Semitism that we see happening and other antis, anti-Muslim, anti-this and that. This is a guy who is now staking his reputation on making us one. And therefore, he wants to incorporate this phrase into our flag and into the way in which we are known. And in that, he is absolutely right.
Certainly, you responded with the idea that this rise in anti-Semitism and all the other antis, including the racial divisions in this country, how much of that, you asked him, could be laid at the feet of the president?
That's right. Well, we all know the answer to that one, and it was a setup question, obviously, because this is a president who has made his reputation by dividing, by going to the place in everybody's psyche, which is very unattractive, and saying, okay, I'm going to go to that place. I can only say that we know what he's doing, and we know why he's doing it. It's up to us to not react and go to that terrible black spot in our psyches, but to go to the light and to say, we're not having it, Mr. President. We can think better than that for ourselves.
You also pushed him on the idea that he is still positioning himself just in case he might decide to run for president.
I think he is. You know, I think there's a real possibility here that if the Democrats lose this election, that he will put himself forward in 24. He eschews that. He doesn't entertain it. But it makes a certain amount of sense that a man with a great ambition, such as he, whose father was denied the right to be president of the United States, he had the right, but he didn't do it. And this is one of the great challenges. I think he will do it. I think he's positioning himself to do that.
Legislative Gazette political observer Alan Chartok. You are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. New York Congressman Sean Patrick Maloney was at the site of a Newburgh lake where PFOS contamination was revealed in 2016. Maloney called on Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell to immediately take up PFAS legislation passed in the House this month. The Legislative Gazette's Allison Dunn was there and filed this report.
New York Congressman Sean Patrick Maloney represents the 18th District, home to both Newburgh and surrounding communities that have been impacted by PFOS contamination.
What we are calling on today is the Senate to act.
The Democrat wrote to Republican Senate Majority Leader McConnell, urging him to take up the PFAS Action Act the House passed January 10th with bipartisan support.
This is not a Democrat or Republican issue. Democrats and Republicans all drink the water together, and we are going to get sick or stay healthy together. And we've got to act in a way that is science-based and with common sense to protect our drinking water. And that's what the PFAS Action Act gets at.
The PFAS Action Act contains 11 bills, one Maloney authored. The PFAS Testing Act, which requires testing of all per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances under the Toxic Substances Control Act by any entity who manufactures or processes PFAS chemicals. The bill also requires the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency to set testing requirements for PFAS and make all results public.
It's quite clear to me that Mitch McConnell's taken his clue from the White House. The president has threatened to veto. And to just say it plainly, it's because there's a lot of powerful interests that don't want this done. There are powerful economic interests that do not want to bear the cost and to have the burden of making sure that what they're doing is not exposing the rest of us to hazardous substances. This is always the tension in environmental legislation.
A statement of administration policy issued January 7th contains the intent to veto. The statement says the PFAS Action Act would require the administration to bypass well-established processes, procedures, and legal requirements of the nation's most fundamental environmental laws, truncating the rulemaking process. The statement also says the bill would create considerable litigation risk and impose a heavy burden on states, local governments, and other potentially responsible parties by requiring them to implement stringent regulations before any consideration of whether such implementation is even feasible.
Yeah, I think they believe that there's a liability concern for some of these companies involved. But of course, you know, perhaps there should be. I mean, the point is not to protect the powerful and the wealthy. The point is to protect people who need clean water. And that is all of us.
Democratic Newburgh Mayor Torrence Harvey.
It's very important on all levels, local, state, federal, that we work together and collaborate, because as Congressman Maloney mentioned, you know, clean water is a right. And the local taxpayers cannot afford the remediation that's needed and necessary to clean up the contaminants at the source, Wreck Pond, coming out of Silver Stream into our Washington Lake, which is behind us.
The city has been drawing its drinking water from the Catskill Aqueduct. Meantime, a temporary filtration system is up and running at the Recreation Pond outflow at Stewart Air National Guard Base, from where some of the highest concentrations of PFOS emanate. Again, Maloney.
We know in the end we don't have to accept the false choice between a strong economy and a clean environment. We can do both.
New York 19th District Congressman Antonio Delgado, a Democrat, is one of the PFAS Action Act's 66 co-sponsors. The act includes a Delgado amendment that would make it illegal for any industrial facility to introduce PFAS into a sewage treatment system without first disclosing information about that substance.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Allison Dunn.
Democratic presidential candidate Michael Bloomberg was in Burlington, Vermont this week. He told supporters and the curious that he's the only candidate who can defeat incumbent Republican President Donald Trump this November. The Legislative Gazette's Pat Bradley was there.
The former mayor of New York City stopped in Burlington to meet with local officials and hold a small rally at the Echo Leahy Science Center on the shore of Lake Champlain. More than 270 people crowded into the venue, causing organizers to scramble to find overflow rooms. Vermont campaign organizer Christopher DeMezzo welcomed the crowd and urged them to volunteer.
Mike is the first presidential candidate this cycle to hold a public event here in Burlington. But that's because Mike is running a different kind of campaign. He's going places people aren't listening to voices that aren't usually heard.
After Bloomberg took the stage, he explained why he came to Vermont.
Somebody said, why are you going up to Vermont? There aren't a lot of delegates coming from there. And I said, wait a second. I'm here to do two things. One, to replace Donald Trump, and two, to pull this country together. And it seemed like a prerequisite, if you're going to pull people together, to sort of include everybody.
Later, Bloomberg told reporters why he is focusing on Super Tuesday states like Vermont.
I'm not competing in the first four early states because first I said I wasn't going to run and then changed my mind because I didn't like what the candidates were doing in terms of their policies. And I didn't think they could beat Donald Trump. So I decided, okay, I'm going to run, least I can do. And going in, it was too late to mount a campaign in any of those four states. I wasn't going to be able to compete, and so I thought I would spend all my time working on all of the other states in the country. And nobody is going to the other states except two people, myself and Donald Trump. And if you want to replace Donald Trump, maybe you might want to visit these states and make the case as to why you're better than Donald Trump.
Bloomberg outlined a number of his successes during his 12 years as mayor of New York City and some of his campaign priorities, including the opioid crisis and climate change. A key theme is unity.
We need to do more than just win in November. We need to unite this country and to bring people together and to start getting big things done. And my whole career, I have been a doer and a problem solver. I believe we need less talk. We need less partisanship. We need less division. And in fact, we need less tweeting. I don't just point fingers. I think we've all had enough of that from President Trump. And we've had him too much dividing us by race and religion and economics and all of those things. We need to bring this country together.
Bloomberg offered stark contrasts between himself and President Trump and told the crowd he's the only candidate who can beat the incumbent.
I think the contrast between Donald Trump and me couldn't be any clearer. I have billed myself as the un-Trump. He breaks promises and I keep them. He's a climate denier and I was trained as an engineer and I actually believe in science. Imagine that. I'm going to do and whatever it takes to beat him.
When Bloomberg entered the presidential campaign in November, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, who is also a Democratic presidential candidate, accused him of attempting to buy the election. Bloomberg scoffs at the thought.
I'm spending my money to try to replace Donald Trump. And when I ask people, is that a good idea? They say, yes, spend more. Bernie Sanders is a local favorite, I'm sure. But what I'm trying to do is to replace Donald Trump and to reunite this country. And it costs money to get to things out.
Why not rely on small donations from individual voters?
Because I don't take any money from anybody.
Michael Bloomberg's complete speech in Burlington is at WAMC.org. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Pat Bradley.
are listening to the Legislative Gazette, a program about New York State government and politics. I'm David Gustina. SUNY Chancellor Christina Johnson delivered her annual State of the University System address last week. As the Legislative Gazette's Lucas Willard reports, Johnson outlined her vision as SUNY approaches its 75th anniversary.
Johnson is the 13th chancellor of the State University of New York system, established in 1948. On Thursday in Albany, she delivered her third State of the University System address, outlining actions to take on challenges like climate change, prepare for automation in the workforce, foster energy independence, and increase diversity.
As we approach SUNY at 75, our goal is to use the power of learning and all the confidence and opportunity it creates to shape a more dynamic future for all New Yorkers in every distinctive part of our state. And we are well on the way.
SUNY turns 75 in 2023, and Johnson set goals in four main categories: individualized learning, innovation and entrepreneurship, sustainability, and partnerships. On her first goal, the chancellor outlined progress on the SUNY Achieve program. The program, first launched at 27 campuses, allows students to receive credit for remedial classes in English and math.
We found that pass rates in these credit-bearing English classes far exceed those of standalone remedial courses. It seems as if you set an expectation for success, students will meet it.
Johnson says SUNY plans to expand the Achieve program across the entire university system and triple the number of students enrolled to 22,000 by SUNY at 75. She also highlighted the success of the SUNY online pilot program launched last year, the Open Education Resources Program, which provides free access to textbooks and other resources, the Re-Enroll to Complete program, and Prodigy, a hiring program designed to increase diversity among faculty. For innovation and entrepreneurship, Johnson wants to double research at SUNY campuses.
In my first year as chancellor, I set a goal of reaching $2 billion in annual research expenditures within 7 years, and we are well on our way to doing that. Our research expenditure system-wide exceeded $1.7 billion in fiscal year 2019. And sponsored research funding is up $136 million from the prior year.
On sustainability, Johnson said SUNY has reduced its greenhouse gases by 39%.
By the end of SUNY at 75 and well ahead of the Climate Act's 2040 deadline, we have set a goal that 100% of SUNY's electricity will come from zero carbon resources.
And on partnerships, Johnson said public and private partnerships have led to $5 billion in research and development investment. Applied Materials opened its $600 million Meta Center at SUNY Poly in Albany in November, and Cree, Inc. is moving forward with plans to construct a $1 billion semiconductor plant at SUNY Nano Center in Marcy, which the state says will create 600 jobs. Toward the end of her 45-minute speech, Johnson touched on themes of bigotry and tolerance. She commended leaders at SUNY New Paltz for removing the names of several slave-owning Huguenot families from campus buildings. She also had words for students, stemming from two incidents in 2019.
I'm also proud of the students at the University of Albany for realizing that a crude slur kicked in the snow and directed at Israel was not a policy position, but hate speech, and for pointing out that hate has no place on our campuses.
Johnson also addressed Binghamton students after a protest there shut out a talk by an author, garnering national headlines.
By refusing to allow conservative economist Arthur Laffer to deliver remarks at Binghamton University, student protesters demonstrated a fundamental misunderstanding of the role of universities, which is to encourage civil debate, not to quell it.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Lucas Willard.
The New York State Sheriff's Association is now employing a new crime suppression initiative. However, its effectiveness and legality will likely be tested. The Legislative Gazette's Dave Lucas reports.
CSI uses synthetic forensic technology capable of tagging criminals with an invisible forensic mist of synthesized DNA composed of shorter chains than human DNA, so police can identify them even months after a crime was committed. It comes in many forms, including water-soluble spray, grease, and gel. CSI Select Executive Vice President Joe Maltese says Albany County Sheriff's deputies and members of the Albany Police Department are currently undergoing training involving working with the technology.
And while it's newer to the U.S., it is not new. It's tried, tested, proven for a very long time, and many, many police agencies in the U.K. and Europe utilize it. And all we want to do is replicate that and have a very good impact in making the community safer for which the law enforcement officers serve.
For less than $100 a month, stores can use the technology to protect their inventory. Maltese says criminals exposed to just a touch of the DNA compound could be apprehended weeks or months later.
No system is impossible to defeat. But first of all, the individual needs to know that they've been marked. And number two, it's very, very robust. Given the synthetic forensic markers, short chain structure, they'd have to be able to identify. All we need is one molecule to be able to analyze this. So that's the beauty of it.
Attorney Derek Hogan with the law firm Tully Rinke has some issues with the technology, including the possibility of a DNA spray device misfiring or an innocent person at a crime scene being tagged by overspray.
It is troubling for me as a potential invasion of privacy to put some type of, for lack of a better term, tracking tool on someone, and then how can we be so sure that's going to pinpoint accuracy in the future?
Maltese believes people just knowing it's there, signage pointing out the mere presence of the DNA technology, will markedly reduce the likelihood of crime. As for concerns over civil liberties,
As long as the defense attorney is notified in writing to know that the evidence is being analyzed, that is not an issue. And as long as, I believe, 60 days prior to a trial. So we definitely did our homework before we come here, especially with the changes in the bail reform law.
For the Legislative Gazette, I'm Dave Lucas.
And that about does it for this week's show. We had help from the New York State Public Radio Network. For copies, call 1-800-323-9262. That's 1-800-323-9262. Ask for program number 2005. Or just listen or podcast on the web at wamc.org. And join us again next week at this same time for more news on New York State government and politics. For the Legislative Gazette, I'm David Giustina.